Okay, sorry about that. Now the volume is better, right? If anyone's having trouble, let us know. I'm going to read that story again just in case you didn't hear it. A man shouted at Prabhupada during a darshan and had to be hustled out of the room. The devotees were quite unnerved and began to speculate as to the offender's future. Would he be sent to some hellish planet? This was all being discussed in front of Prabhupada. Would he be born in a decrepit condition here on earth? How would he become free of his offense? After the discussion went back and forth among the devotees for some time, Srila Prabhupada looked up and offered, "We could forgive him," an option no one else had thought of. Interesting, isn't it, that no one had thought of that option? Which you would think would be the natural option to think of, at least for a devotee, or someone who's practicing Krishna consciousness, but somehow or other, they were so upset, that was not even an option in their minds. But it was an option in Prabhupada's mind. Okay. Another great story coming right up. There was once two saints, and they went to the bank of a river. They saw that a scorpion was in the current of that river. One of the saintly persons picked up that scorpion on his palm to save him, but the scorpion bit him and again fell into the stream. Again the saint lifted out the scorpion, and again he stung. But again the saint picked him up. His friend said, "Why are you doing this? Let's go. Don't try to save him. Let him die." That saint replied, "If this scorpion is not giving up his nature to bite, why should I give up my nature to save him?" And again he went to save him. You should be like this. If someone does something against you, don't take revenge. We should try to follow the instruction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If you want to be able to always chant the holy name of Krishna, then follow this instruction. Obviously, Prabhupada's talking about the Trinadapi Sunichena, to be more humble than a blade of grass, that instruction from Mahaprabhu. The nature of devotees is very sweet. They don't disturb anyone. They never use harsh words when speaking to anyone. They have very sweet behavior, and they speak sweetly. So this is so instructive. And we were discussing in earlier classes about Thakur Haridas blessing those who were trying to kill him. And we made the same point that it's the nature of a devotee to be merciful and to give blessings. So no matter what the situation, he'll always give blessings. It's not conditional. And you'll find in India, people will go to saintly person, and when they go to saintly person, they'll always say, "Maharaj, Gurudev, please give me your blessings." Because they know that is the nature of the sadhu, to give blessings. Of course, they may not always want the kind of blessings that the sadhu gives. Generally, they want blessings to help them materially, but the sadhus may give other blessings. They may give blessings that will not help you materially, that will help you spiritually, that will detach you from material things. That's another thing. But the point is, the sadhu, he's always giving blessings. That's his nature. Just as an envious person, or we say a snake, is always envious. They'll bite anyone. That's their nature, to bite. The scorpion nature is to bite. So what is the nature of the Vaishnava? Vaishnava's nature is to be compassionate. So we can think of this story sometimes when we feel like taking revenge or becoming upset. We can think of the story and think, yes, I am sadhu, at least I'm trying to be a sadhu, so I should adopt that nature. You like that story? Good story, isn't it? Now, I have another good story. And all these stories relate to things that we have discussed. But when they take the form of stories, they're special. And oftentimes they're more memorable in this form. And this is an Indian story, American Indian story. It's called Two Wolves. One evening, an old Cherokee told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. Two wolves inside us all. One is evil. One wolf is evil. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego." And, by the way, I want to make a distinction. Jealousy is when you want something that another person has, and envy is when you don't want them to have it. The other side is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" In other words, the two wolves, the wolf of evil and the wolf of good. Which wolf wins? There's two wolves inside of us. The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed." Nice. Which wolf are you feeding? I hope you're not feeding the evil wolf inside of you. Because you know what happens when you feed the evil wolf? The evil wolf becomes more energized. And we're going to talk about that later, about the kind of energy that we feed, that when we feed resentment, the kind of energy that produces. Okay. Now, would you like to hear more stories? All of you out there? I can hear you all saying yes. Okay, let's read another story. Feed that good wolf. Or as we say, we can take that to the Vedic paradigm or the Vedic analogy, not analogy, the Vedic fact, in which Srila Prabhupada said, within the body, the way he explained it was, that in previous ages, the suras and the asuras, the divine, the godly people and the ungodly people, they actually lived on separate planets. There were planets of the suras, planets of the asuras. Then Srila Prabhupada said, I believe he explained it this way, then in the next age, they lived on the same planet but in different areas. He made this, you know, then they came to the same planet, but they didn't associate it. Some progression like that. And then it gradually evolved in Kali Yuga. He said, and now the sura, the godly and the ungodly, they live in the same body. So we all know that. We experience that. The two wolves. The godly wolf and the ungodly wolf. Okay. Two wolves. Okay, here's another nice story. This is from a small young girl, a six-year-old girl in New Orleans. New Orleans, if you're not in America, that's in the south of America. In the south of America, there was apartheid or segregation, even up till the 1960s, or late 50s, early 60s. A six-year-old girl in New Orleans is the first black student to attend a mixed school after apartheid. Apartheid is segregation. So this is a story about the girl. She's the first one, first black girl who's ever gone to a school with white people. The white people were so disturbed. I mean, this is, you know, 50 years ago. There was a lot of prejudice against black people. The white people were so disturbed, not that there isn't today, but it was very intense at that time. The white people were so disturbed that a black girl was going to a school that was formerly all white that she had to be escorted by federal marshals. She had to be escorted by federal marshals. It was dangerous. They thought someone might attack her. Someone might kill her. It's a six-year-old girl. The white students boycotted the school. And there were mobs of people protesting and screaming at her every day when she went to school and when she left school. Can you imagine that? Just try to visualize that scene. There's mobs of people screaming at her as she walks into school. She's a six-year-old girl. And every day when she walks into school, and every day when she leaves school, there's mobs of white people screaming at her. I mean, can you imagine what they were saying? I don't want to even try. Horrible things they were saying to her. And she would be saying something under her breath as she walked in. Nobody could hear what she was saying, but she was saying something to herself. When asked what she was saying, she said, "I am praying to God to forgive them." When asked why she would do that, she said, "Don't you think they need to be forgiven?" It's a six-year-old girl. Amazing. Amazing. She must have cultivated that in another lifetime. And she was, actually, you could see, she was feeling sorry for them. We were talking about this, and I read a quote about this, and I'll read you some other quotes if there's time. How, instead of feeling aggression towards someone who's hurt you, it just as easily you can feel sorry for that person that they would have to stoop to such a low position to do something against you because they themselves are hurting so much, or they themselves are so distraught, so they themselves are so disturbed that they would act that way. And then you can feel sorry for them, feel sympathy for them that they're in that situation. Amazing. Okay. Would you like to hear another story? More stories, definitely more stories. So this, you know, one of the realizations I had about this story, and I got this realization when I was reading Radhanath Swami's book. If you haven't read the book, I definitely recommend getting it. Can they get it here at Krishna.com, Uddhava? Yes, you can get it. And what's it called? My Journey Home? I believe it's called My Journey Home by Radhanath Swami. So, in reading Radhanath Swami's book, one of the things that came up was that he had taken a vow in the course of his traveling from America to India and his experience. He had taken a vow at one point not to eat meat. Then he had taken a vow at another point not to take any drugs. And then he had taken a vow at another point to be celibate. This was all done before he was a devotee, and this was all done without any connection with India and Indian philosophy and the connection of why he should do that. It was just realizations based on experience. So that and other things that he was realizing, and then I was thinking, yes, of course, when you cultivate spiritual advancement in one life, then there's so many things you already know without reading them, because they come with you from one life to another. So otherwise, how would a six-year-old girl have this realization unless she cultivated that? And it's nice to understand that, because just like Krishna says, there's no loss. Whatever spiritual advancement you make, you keep. So it's within our consciousness, when we develop this nature to be forgiving, when we develop a compassionate nature. Yes, the book is called, The Journey Home, Autobiography of an American Swami. It's on Krishna.com. You can find it there. We're looking at it right now. So, when we cultivate these qualities, we're talking here about cultivating forgiveness, but we've also been talking about how it's necessary to cultivate humility, sympathy, compassion, because these are all foundational to the development of forgiveness. And then if we do that, and we don't become completely Krishna conscious in this life, that will carry over in our next life. And we've already understood what it means to be humble, compassionate. These things will just come to us. We'll realize, we'll have deep realizations about these things, even without reading, even without a teacher. It'll just come through life's experience, because we already have it in our consciousness. So it's a nice meditation in thinking, whatever I'm developing now in my consciousness will remain, and that, okay, I have so many years to live in this life, and that is my window of opportunity to purify my consciousness, to develop saintly qualities, to come closer to Krishna, and all that will remain if I don't become perfect. It's not that we should think, well, automatically, if I start out in my next life better, that solves the whole problem. No, we're still going to deal with what the problems, the attachments, unwanted desires, and so forth. We're going to deal with that from the past. So let's read another story. I haven't even read this story. Perhaps I read it years ago, so I didn't read it before the class. So I'm reading it really for the first time in years, and I don't even know what it is. So let's find out what it is. On March 23rd, 1995, my 17-year-old daughter, Nicole, opened the door of her father's house to a 16-year-old young man named Levon, whom she knew. Levon came into the house and they began to argue over drugs. Levon picked up the butcher knife from the kitchen counter and stabbed Nicole to death. My only child lay dying on the floor of the living room, her eyes still open. The last sight she saw that day was the face of the young man who was killing her. This young man, who I had never met in my life, came into my life that day and changed my life forever. I waited 1 year to be faced with the young man who had changed my life forever. He was hostile and angry during the trial. My greatest fear was that he would get the death penalty, and that I would then have to fight to never allow that to happen. But God knew that wasn't how he wanted me to spend my time. Levon was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 38 years with no probation. God had other plans for my life. Levon still looked angry when he was sentenced 2 weeks later. Only now he was sitting right next to me as I stood at the podium to address the court and the judge. But I was warned not to address Levon. I was told I couldn't speak to this person who had changed my life forever, and he was sitting right next to me. I began reading what I had written, and then God spoke to my heart. I needed to talk to this young man. It might be my only opportunity. I turned and looked into his face. This was the face that my daughter saw as she lay dying on the living room floor just 1 year ago. And now I was looking into that same face. I told Levon I was not angry. I told Levon I was not angry with him, but that I felt very hurt. I told him that I had compassion for him, and that I hoped that he could somehow find a way to turn his life around. And lastly, I told him that I would be praying for him. The face that was so full of anger was now looking at me in disbelief, and the anger was gone. When I walked away from the courthouse that day, I knew that God had given both of us a gift. It was the gift of forgiveness. I was able to forgive the young man who murdered my daughter, not because he asked me to, but because it was what God wanted for both of us. God was never going to be able to use me if I was angry. Forgiveness brings peace, and with that peace comes overwhelming joy. The joy of knowing that God will forgive me just as I have forgiven. Incredible story, almost unbelievable, that a person could forgive someone who killed his daughter, but to speak of killing his daughter in front of him. So, this is a wonderful story. So now, taking off on that story, I want to read something to you. I think it's appropriate that the story illustrates something. Something that could have happened to this man if he didn't forgive. And this is written by a friend of mine named Archana Siddhi, who is a therapist, and we are in the process of developing a course on forgiveness that's going to be given online, perhaps a 1 or 2 month course online. And she sent me something she had written. I want to read this to you because it really struck me as something powerful. Resentment keeps us emotionally rooted in the past. We have a limited supply of energy at our disposal. We have so many units of energy to expend on our physical, mental, and spiritual health and growth. Keeping resentment alive requires a large output of energy, which drains us of the resources for a healthy, progressive life. Let me read that again. This is really the key here. Keeping resentment alive requires a large output of energy, which drains us of the resources for a healthy, progressive life. It is similar to allocating money to take care of our current and future needs. If we are paying off a large debt from the past, we may not have enough money left to meet our immediate needs, what to speak of our future requirements. Closing the resentment account will free up a lot of needed energy that we can then use to go forward in our lives. So this is a very important point. The 2 points she's making is that resentment, because it's something that has happened in the past, it's connecting us to a past experience, and it's kind of like a chain or an anchor to a past experience. And that past experience is still affecting us at the present time. And the way she's saying it's affecting us is that it is pulling energy out of us. So that's leaving less energy to deal with other aspects of our life, because we only have so much energy. And any one of you can experience, if you let go of resentment, you will experience this release of this energy that was draining you, and immediately feel much freer and lighter and energetic and more positive, more enthusiastic. That is my personal experience, and that is the experience I have in seeing others when they give up their resentment. So another example is given that if you have something that floats and you want to hold it down, she gives this example also that sometimes we are not acknowledging the resentment, we're not dealing with it, we're running away from it, or we're ignoring it, and unconsciously we're kind of keeping it buried, and it takes energy to keep it buried. And my experience is that anytime an individual has a problem that they're not solving, I don't want to say any time, but generally when a person has a problem they're not solving, it's because they're afraid to deal with it for whatever reason. They can't deal with it. It's so distasteful to deal with, or it's so difficult to deal with. They just want to avoid it, or as we say, denying the reality of the situation, that this is really there. I don't want to think about it. It's so difficult for me to think about it. It's so difficult. I don't even know how to deal with it. I don't even know where to start. And so we want to run away from it. And so a lot of times we'll bury the resentment because we don't want to deal with it. But it's taking energy to keep it in there. And I think it is probably one of the worst things that we can ever do, is have a problem that we're running away from because it's never solved that way, instead of facing it directly and acknowledging this is a problem, acknowledging this is how I feel, and then dealing with it. A lot of times we're afraid to acknowledge how we feel, that we really are upset, we really are angry. And by not acknowledging it, we can't deal with it. Now, she mentions another thing which relates to this, and that what's going on inside of us when we have issues of anger or resentment. And she's making the point that the anger and the resentment is not the real problem. There's something that's caused it. It's only a symptom. It's a secondary, what we would say is a secondary emotion. There's something that triggered it. So listen to this. I'll answer your question. April, answer your question in a minute. anger often, excuse me, anger often masks sadness, disappointment, and hurt. It becomes like a protective armor, shielding us from having to face more painful feelings. Let me read that again. It becomes like a protective armor, shielding us from having to face more painful feelings. In other words, I'm angry, but there's something I'm not facing. Could be disappointment, sadness. I was let down by somebody. I was hurt by somebody. And to protect myself because I'm not facing it, I just become angry or resentful. So I'm not really dealing with the issue. I'm avoiding the issue. And the anger is supposed to protect me, be like some kind of bomb or something to numb that pain. And I'm not acknowledging the pain. Anger can become an addictive emotional response similar to a drug or alcohol. Wow. Anger can become an addictive emotional response similar to a drug or alcohol. Anger as a drug, very interesting concept. Something that is numbing the pain. I'm feeling that I'm not acknowledging what that pain is. When we cut ourselves off from feeling uncomfortable and hurtful feelings, we also cut ourselves off from the emotional growth that comes with having to cope with sadness and disappointment. So she's making the same point. Acknowledge if you're hurt, acknowledge it, and then deal with it. A lot of us are afraid to acknowledge feelings, and because we think, well, I shouldn't feel that way, and I'm a bad person if I feel that way. But the reality is we do feel that way, and if we acknowledge the feeling and deal with it, then we can move beyond that. We can process it and understand it better. So when we see anger and resentment, then the light should go off and say, no, there's something else. Something else happened. I'm not just angry. I've been hurt. I've been let down. I've been disappointed. I'm sad. I've been saddened by someone. And I have to deal with that. So now I'm going to go to April's question. April says, if you release an issue, how do you handle it if it creeps back up? Well, first, there are certain strategies that you can employ, or certain symptoms of understanding that you haven't forgiven somebody. And one of the primary symptoms of not having forgiven someone is that you still are going over the story in your mind, or you still are going over the story by telling it to other people. So if you see that tendency is there to go over it in your mind or to tell someone about it, then catch yourself if you can and don't talk about it. Because if you want to forgive, at the point you want to forgive or let it go, letting it go means let the story go. Now, part of the problem of it creeping back in is you have the same story. You haven't seen it from a different point of view. Generally, we can't give up resentment because we're in the victim mode, the victim mentality. I was hurt. They did this to me. It's not fair. I'm innocent. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm the innocent victim. As long as you remain in the victim consciousness that I'm not to blame, I didn't do anything wrong, it's all their fault. As long as you're in that consciousness, there's every chance that it's going to creep back up because you have the same story, the victim story. And you haven't let the victim story go. So how do you let the victim story go? Well, one way you let the victim story go, as we said previously, is tell the story from their point of view. So how do you do that? Well, one of the things you do is you try to understand the principle that when someone does something, they are attempting to fulfill their needs. They're doing it to fulfill a need they have. whether they're conscious of that need or they're not conscious of it, they're doing it to fulfill their need. So then you would have to think, what need was this person trying to fulfill by acting the way they did towards me? And then so you enter their world and understand they had a need. The need may be perverted. I'll give you an example. There was a boy who was found and arrested for sexually abusing children. And when they investigated the case, the one thing they found was that he was very nice to the children. He really liked them. It's like, well, why was he abusing them if he liked them? It was a very strange situation. He would bring them to his home, and he would take care of them, he'd feed them, they'd play games, they'd have a great time. He really liked kids, and he liked being with the kids. And then he would sexually abuse them, molest them. And they asked him why, and he said, because when I was young, I was sexually abused, and nobody can feel my pain, and I need people to feel my pain. And by abusing these children, they'll be able to relate to me and feel my pain. Say, oh my God, what is wrong with this kid? But somehow or other, you have to enter his world to understand that his need, he had the need to be heard. He had the need to be related to. And the way he did that was molesting children. So somehow or other, you have to try to understand what needs this person was trying to fulfill. Now there's another thing we talked about, and that's conditioning. You try to understand as best you can how this person was raised, what kind of life they had. You know, sometimes you'll find people whose parents, one or both parents were alcoholics, or they were only raised by one parent, and the parent was working, and they were never around, and the parent couldn't deal with it, and they were always being yelled at or being told that they're useless. You know, I mean, you may not know the whole story behind this person who hurt you. So you imagine yourself being in that situation and living the life this person lived and having the experiences this person had. You try to, as much as possible, see from their point of view and see if you can tell another story. Well, I did this because I was abused or I was hurt. I was going through a difficult time and I didn't understand, misunderstood your intention, I made the wrong assumption, or I was put in a situation which was too difficult for me to handle. I was doing the best I could. I didn't realize how difficult it would be. I never thought I would stoop to this. I was at a low point in my life, etc., etc. So if you can understand that, and then your story starts to change. Well, it's not just about you being a victim, but it's about this person who's hurting, who's having trouble. And then maybe you come to a point where you're more compassionate towards that person and you alter your victim consciousness. Another way of dealing with victim consciousness is you tell the story. Usually when we tell our story about our hurt, our anger, our resentment, we're telling it from the victim mode, that I was in the situation, I was perfectly innocent, just behaving myself, not doing anything wrong, and then this person came along and did this stupid thing and totally let me down, and now I have this anger. Try telling your story by taking responsibility for what happened rather than taking the victim role. For example, you say, this person came into... I'll give you an example. This is a real-life example. That I was told by a woman... She told her victim's story. Her victim's story was her actually her husband had run off. They had a dual bank account. He had run off with the money and left her and sold the house. You know, some scenario like that. So she was telling me the story, you know, the victim's story. You know, I had trusted him. I had done this. I had done that. I'd been a good wife. And then he had turned against me. Taken the money, it was our joint account, our life savings, now I have nothing. We sold our home to pay off debt, he took the savings, I'm stranded, etc., etc. So then we said, so now what we'd like you to do is tell that story, but don't tell it as a victim. Tell the story from another perspective. And the perspective we want you to tell it is, that you take total responsibility for what happened. So at first this is hard. I mean, how can I take responsibility? He did that. But this was how she was asked to see it. So then what she did, she said, well, I should have, I know what my husband is like, and it was stupid of me to have a joint account. I shouldn't have done this. This was my money, which I earned. They hadn't been married that long. So, when you're married, they were married, they were older, and they'd been married before. So, you know, people may want to keep their own money. So, you know, so she took responsibility that I had trusted him. I should have seen that he was not trustworthy with money. I should have anticipated this possibly could have happened. But I made that decision to do that. And so she went through the scenario. I think she even went as far as that I shouldn't have married him. I should have understood that he has this nature, and it was my foolishness to be involved with him. I don't know if they were married or they were just living together. But so you can see, when the story's changed, then everything looks different. And then the idea of forgiving, the resentment creeping back, it's a different ball game now, because you have a different story, and the story is, no, I shouldn't have done that, it was my fault. So where's the resentment for this person? There's no resentment for this person. There's just a learning experience for me. You see? Okay. Now, that was a lesson in psychology. I didn't quote any verses. Some people are going to be listening to this and say, he didn't quote any verses. He's bogus. And sometimes I even think that myself. But some of these things are necessary to understand, at least for some of us in certain situations. Okay, so one of the things I wrote Dr. Greg about forgetting is there's a saying, forgive and don't forget. Don't forget that you've forgiven. Next week, I believe I have a list of a checklist to know how you're forgiven. Actually, I do have this in my seminars. I give this out. It's a checklist of so many things you can look at, and I'll see if I can make that available on my website. It'll be very helpful for you. And what it does is, it takes you through all the steps we go through in our seminar to help people forgive, all the things they have to do, and then it serves as a checklist, so that you can go back and see, okay, I thought I'd forgiven, but now I see it creeping back up, and then you can go back and look at the checklist. And the idea is that either you should go through each item on the checklist, and either, I forget how it works, either be doing it or not be doing it, and that would mean you've fully forgiven. So I think this would be very good for you. So let's go to Bhakti Carol. My ex-husband injured me and left me to die in August. Wow. Very heavy. August 2002, I was hospitalized for 4 months. It took another year to learn to walk again. During this time, I also suffered a stroke from blood clots. Once I understood what had happened, surgeons talked with me for 2 days. I forgave the ex-husband immediately. It's just my actual response. Bhakti and Carol, you're amazing. I was able for the first time to walk on my own to the Dallas Temple in August 2004. I took this man to the temple for Arti. He smelled the flower and had prasadam. In 2006, he was in prison for another reason, and I sent him photos of the devotees and deities, which he showed to many other inmates who were eager to see my mail. Eager to see any male, even if not their own. So the ex-husband, who had previously had no contact with devotees, ended up introducing Krishna's name and image to others. He ended up preaching to others. What a wonderful story. Bhakti and Carol, can you send me that story? I mean, you send it to me if you would allow me to use that in the future in some seminars. Mahat, mahat@aol.com, if you don't mind. That's a wonderful story. You are a real saint. Hare Krishna. Arti is asking, what to think about pregnancy and birth control among teenagers? Well, that is a whole other topic. So why don't you send me an email and we'll discuss that on email. Dr. Greg, give yourself credit. You're as good as my psychologist. You want to hear something amazing? I am not a psychologist, but maybe I was a psychologist in my last life. I don't know. And I was helping a girl who came to a program in New York. She had serious, serious problems. And I had read books on psychology and self-help and so forth. So I was helping her, dealing with some of her problems. We had done a 2-hour introductory forgiveness seminar. And so, at the end, she said the same thing. You know, she said, in this half hour, I got more help from you than my psychologist. So maybe I should be a psychologist. Maybe I should be charging you all right now to listen to me. Hare Krishna. You are so fortunate, you don't have to pay. You can get this all free. That's all Krishna's mercy. So, website is tstrain.com, www.tstrain.com. And I placed an article up there. I mentioned last week an article entitled My Resentment. If you go to my website and go to articles, not newsletters, but articles, and you scroll down to the bottom, the last article is entitled My Resentment. We read from that last week, and I highly recommend that article. It's helped a lot of devotees. And so what I'm saying is, next week I'm going to put this, How Do You Know You're Forgiven? And it just goes through all the principles. And perhaps what we'll do on next week's show is we'll go through the principles on this chart. And it's really very powerful. I mean, I spent a lot of time developing the seminar. So there's so many things I haven't given you yet. And this is one thing I think I should give you. It'll be very helpful. So, okay. So now, I want to do something which I think it will really help you a lot, and we do this in our seminars. And I'm going to need your participation here. So, everybody, please get ready to participate. We're going to need some feedback from you and from all of you, as much as you want to give. One of the things that we understand is that whenever we do something, we do it to avoid pain or to gain pleasure or both. If you can do both at the same time, you're doing double duty there. So at least we'll do something to avoid pain. If it's not for pleasure, then, you know, oh, there's a snake. Run the other way. I want to avoid the pain. So we do things for a reason. There's what we call a payoff. I did this. Why did I do this? Because I wanted to get something or I wanted to avoid something. So now what we want to do is we want to look at the payoffs. What do we get by holding on to resentment? Because we have to be getting something. If we're not getting something, why are we doing it? We're not doing it just because it's fun to harass people, or it's fun to torment ourselves by holding on to a grudge or being angry all the time or telling everybody what a victim we are. That's not fun. So we do it for a reason. So it can be either something you personally experience where you're holding on to a grudge or holding on to resentment and you're reflecting why, or it can be something that you intuitively understand why people would do it, or it could be something that you've seen in other people. So I would like you to just on chat, just write down anything that comes to mind of why you or why you think other people would hold on to resentment. What's the payoff? What are they getting from it? And I'm going to start. I'll start here. And I've got here a copy from one of my seminars of what the participants said. So I'm going to read one. One of the reasons is we can... Thank you, Madan Mohan. I also have a guitar. I rock on that as well. And anyway, new CD is in... going to come out soon. We're working on it. One more song left. Okay, so excuses. You know, what's the payoff? One payoff, this was presented by the participants in the course. One payoff is I can blame others for my karma. In other words, I don't have to take responsibility that I'm deserving this. Just, well, you know, I can blame. It's his fault. He did it. Nothing to do with me. I can blame others for my karma. Okay. Samsara 78. Does that mean you've... All right, we won't try to understand what your name means. Samsara 78. They hold on to resentment because they don't know another way. That is true, but we're looking... You could say, okay, let's say it's a comfort zone. It's like, we could say, okay, that makes sense. Feels comfortable. It's like being in pain is kind of a comfort zone. For some reason. There's probably, could be many reasons. Maybe it is our society that does not teach such knowledge. It's not a conversation that I've had with my family or friends. That is true. And I think that also relates to our condition, you know, we're talking here cultural conditioning, and it may be, it's unnatural for us to forgive. We haven't learned. We feel uncomfortable forgiving. We don't know how to do it. Bhakti Jeff says, telling others about my resentment towards another feels good somehow, and I think it's because the resentment is burning me, and letting that steam out helps, though the fire doesn't dissolve. Well, both things are true, because telling others about your resentment can work therapeutically to let it go, but it can also work as a weapon to get back at the person. So the payoff can be either one, that we're holding on to it and telling people because we actually want to let it go, we want to process it, and that's why we're telling people. Or we're telling people because we want to put that person in a bad light. And so by telling other people, we think we're going to be hurting that person by letting other people know how bad that person is. So it can go either way. Madame Mohan says, I think it is because people don't know how to make up or move on. The lack of communication is too difficult to confront the person. Holding on to something, it's easier to hold on to it. It feels more comfortable to hold on to it. So I'll just, you know, there's some kind of perverted form of security and comfort in holding on to it. It's like, you know, it's kind of, or I think for some people, it kind of, you know, some people are very aggressive and hateful, and it would become awkward for them to give it up because their personality is such that those are the kind of things that create their self-image, the hate, the resentment, the envy. That's like, they may identify with that, and so they want to hold on to that. Bhakti Greg says, I hold on to resentment because the person who hurt me was a very integral part of my life who had vowed never to leave my life. So you hold on to it because that person disappointed you, and you're feeling the disappointment, the sadness they created in your life, and that's producing, and that it's hard to come to grips with. You know the saying, there's a saying, it's much easier, I think we read this, it's much easier to forgive someone you don't know well than someone you do know well. So when a person's close to us and they hurt us, it hurts worse because someone we don't know may hurt us and say, well, you know, that's, people hurt you, that's the way the world is. But someone who's close to you, they're not supposed to hurt you. So you may be holding on to it because you feel the need to feel the pain because it was such a person who was so close to you. And that pain and somehow is giving you some kind of, it's giving you some kind of solace. That's a secondary emotion. Now, if you go further emotionally, you'll find under the pain, there's another stage where you can go further, if you can get through the pain, to begin to get to that next stage where you begin to understand why they did it and have some appreciation or sympathy for why they did it. Madame Mohan, understanding other people's perspective requires a different level of energy and skill set. Getting angry and holding resentment is much easier. Lots of times it's also an acquired skill from your parents, relatives, or friends. Yeah, it's like what's coming up again is the comfort zone. It's like, well, this is what's getting angry for me is comfortable. This is what I know I know how to do it. I've done it all my life. I learned it from my parents. I learned it from my culture. And this is how I react. I just scream and have a temper tantrum, and you know, feel it kind of feels okay, or that's, you know, that's the only way I know how to do it. So again, it's like the payoff is I don't have to do anything about it. It's just I feel comfortable. Okay. What else? So Bhakti Greg says, I'm a guitar man too. The blues. Oh. So Bhakti Greg, can you write us a blues song about your resentment, but with a happy ending? That would be nice. Yeah, let's have a happy blues song. So, samsara, my mother left and my father blamed me. I feel you, Greg, yeah. These things are, you know, in the age we're living in, things are happening to us that really shouldn't have to happen. And it's going to require tremendous amounts of strength on our part to be able to overcome the forgiveness. But one of the things that we find is that people who have gone through these difficult situations where they've been neglected by parents or relatives or have had alcoholic parents or whatever, some of those people become the strongest, most psychologically healthy people in the world because they had so much to go through to become strong that they became very strong people. And now they're in a position to help other people go through difficulties because of what they went through. So it's always important to never take the victim role where we feel disempowered, that we can't do anything. But it's always the empowered position is, okay, I was dealt with this deck of cards, so let me deal with it. Let me make the best use of it. Let me see how I can move on. And as we said in the beginning, if we hold on to resentment, it anchors us to an experience, a negative experience, and then it's pulling back at us, and then we can't go forward. And when we did one of our seminars, we asked the devotees to visualize what their resentment looks like, and then one of the devotees came to the front and acted it out, and she acted out a sprinter. So the market said go, but her foot was chained, and she couldn't run. So I think it's a good analogy that, you know, we want to move forward in our life, but we're chained by a past experience. So it requires a lot of strength. And if you look at the process of Krishna consciousness, what Krishna consciousness teaches you as something that nourishes or fosters the ability to open our hearts, to be more compassionate, more loving, more caring, then you can use the inspiration you get to develop those qualities to be able to release the resentment. And then use that release as a totally spiritual, as a kind of spiritual sadhana to release that. And take it as Krishna is doing this to me so that I will become stronger, so that I will learn how to overcome this particular obstacle. And then it can be a very positive thing. And if you take it as a positive thing, it's less likely that resentment's going to come back because now you'll see it as something that's helping you become a more forgiving person. That's helping you become a more compassionate person. So you could say, without the difficulty I went through, I may not have learned how to be as compassionate as I am today, or as sympathetic. I may not have learned to see things from other people's points of view. But because of the difficulty I went through, I was forced to do it if I was going to overcome the resentment I had. And then I can appreciate that there was so much benefit in that. And so it becomes a very positive thing. And then you can kind of change your past experience. Now it looks more positive. And you can be happy. Say, yeah, that was a good thing. I wouldn't wish anyone would go through it, and I wouldn't want to go through it again, but I can see how much it helped me. So that's a positive thing. Okay. Madan Mohan, it also shifts the blame on the other person. You might have been wrong, but by resentment, you justify your own wrong behavior. Kind of like the story you told. So, we all have a need to be right. Right? So if you justify wrong behavior, then you can fulfill your need to be right. The need to be right is very strong. It's amazing how strong it is. It's so strong that if you take two people and you put them together and you say, I would like you to argue with one another, and all I would like you to say is, I'm right, and the other person will say, no, I'm right, and then you just argue back, no, I'm right. I'm right. No, I'm right. I'm right. And I've done this exercise in my seminars, and what you'll see is people really get into it. They really get into arguing about being right, but they're not talking about anything to be right about. They were just told to say, I'm right. And it connects to the emotional need to be right, and they really get into it. And they can really feel how strong the desire is to be right. And then you can see that a lot of times people are arguing about something, and it's not even a question of making a point about the particular thing they're talking about. It's just a question, I have to be right. Very interesting, isn't it? Blame the other person, I can be right. You know, it's the whole blaming the other person is victim consciousness, and they'll take responsibility for the situation. So, samsara is saying I've become very strong due to suffering. Yeah, suffering is, you know, a lot of times if you don't suffer or if life's too easy, then when things get difficult, you can't deal with it. But when you go through difficulties, you become very resilient. And you kind of can handle everything. You say, well, I've been through this. It's like everything else is downhill from there. And so, you know, Krishna might see that we need that we have a certain weakness. So he'll put us in a situation to help us become stronger. And then when we go through that situation, we can become teachers and we can help other people who are going through that situation. Because ultimately, all teachers teach through experience. And whatever you study, read in a book, you're reading other people's experience. And if you have your own experience, you become a great teacher. I went to a seminar which was training us how to do seminars. And one of the things they did was they asked everyone to look at what they want to teach. And one of the ways they taught us was, have you any life experience gone through a difficulty from a weak situation to a strong situation? Because if you have, you're in a position to help others who are in the situation you were in to get to the situation you're in now. You know, if you were... There's a commercial, I don't know if you ever saw this, years ago I saw this commercial, and it's this guy who is trading in the stock market, and it shows he has this program, and he has three or four computer screens, and he's looking at all the computers, and he developed this formula. He was just really smart. He figured the whole market out, and he saw how everything was moving, and he trains people how to do it, and it shows his history, and he says, you know, they showed him in Central Park, and they videoed in on the bench. He goes, this is the bench I used to sleep on. I lived in the park. I had nothing. And he said, one day this, you know, idea dawned on me about how to deal with the stock market, and he actually did it, and he became extremely wealthy. So, you know, life is like that. You may be downtrodden, and you figure out how to get back on your feet, and then you can help other people. So, turning poison into medicine. Yes, that's good. Forget the blues tune tonight. Yeah. Maybe Bhakti Greg, you won't be singing the blues after this course. You'll be singing the happies. RT says, some people will see it as a cop-out. Yes. So April has to leave us. Okay, Madama Han's saying, just curious, what seminars are you referring to and how come we have Japa meditation in San Jose? So the seminar I'm referring to is called Living a Life of Total Forgiveness, and I developed it as a 7-hour seminar, and now I'm working on it to develop it as an entire weekend seminar, because I realized how much purification we can do when we focus on forgiveness, how so many things are connected with it. It's such an interesting phenomenon because of what it takes to forgive. And how it gives, it's a gateway to introspect in other areas of our Krishna consciousness. So as far as wanting this seminar, if you want the seminar, we can bring it to wherever you are. If there's enough people interested in, then I'm happy to do it. I love to do it. It's so much fun. And not just fun is not the wrong word, of course. I love doing it. It's fun for me. may not be fun for you until you forgive. I may put you through hell until you forgive, but no, it's not that bad. How can we have japa meditation in San Jose? That also you can discuss, and then you can. I think you already had a few there, and our next japa course is in Houston. That starts the middle of June, japa retreat, if you want to come there. Otherwise, you know, you can discuss with us in your temple, and we can discuss coming out there. Another course I did was a course on prayer, and I want to tell you something. Very, very interesting thing happened. When I do my course on forgiveness, I designed it to go through stages because I see there are necessary stages one has to go through to be able to forgive. So the course is, you know, it builds upon itself. One step, it's like a step to the next step to the next step. If I went immediately to the 10th step, people wouldn't be able to forgive. But if I go to the first step, the second, third, fourth, fifth, by the time we get sixth or seventh, it's just very easy to let it go. So I did the seminar once, but the day before the seminar, I did a seminar on prayer. And the whole mood of the prayer was opening our heart to Krishna as someone who's praying for pure bhakti, not praying for anything material, and really developing that paradigm of allowing Krishna to use us and being open to Krishna, opening our heart. So a very interesting thing happened during that seminar. The devotees opened their hearts so much that when we started the forgiveness seminar, within about the first hour, an hour and a half, everybody just let their issue go because their heart had become so open and softened from spending the whole previous day in prayer, in focusing on the essence of prayer, what prayer is, and offering prayers, creating prayers, and bringing the prayer mood into our japa. So you can see that forgiveness is really, it's really a heart, it's really the heart chakra. It's the world of the heart, of opening up the heart, softening the heart. And that's why it's such a valuable exercise or seminar, because it's so purifying. You know, the Krishna consciousness means to have a soft heart. And the Nectar of Devotion says, have a heart like gold. It just easily melts. So, Madam Mahan, you can email me, or you can, why don't you email me, and then I'll give you my phone number, and we can talk. So that's mahat@aol.com. So Nebraska, we can come to Nebraska. We can go anywhere. We're ready to go, but of course we have to arrange where there are people. We can do this seminar to non-devotees. It's very powerful. I've done it with non-devotees, and it just brings in the whole concept of karma and karma as the teacher of what you learn, and it explains to people. And people have such a difficult idea with the whole concept of evil. Why, if there's a God, why is there evil? When you explain karma as teacher, and they go into their own life and look at all the things they learn through suffering, it becomes very clear that that's God's instrument, and it's God's mercy, and it really helps them. And then it can help them enter into the world of forgiveness. And if they enter into the world of forgiveness, they're softening or opening up their heart. And we're taking them into the more of the, you know, Satvagun, or the border of the transcendental world. So anyway, let's talk, mahat@aol.com. And it is now 9:10. Yes, it's a universal topic, which is one of the reasons I chose to teach it, because I felt it was such a great gateway to Krishna consciousness for non-devotees, and such a necessity for devotees, because I saw so many devotees were holding on to issues of resentment, and despite their advancement in Krishna consciousness, many could not let it go. And you know, for certain personality types or certain people with certain karma, it's much more difficult to let resentment go. Other people, saw that story of Carol, you know, I mean, who could imagine letting that go? And she said immediately she let it go. Certain people are like that. Other people, it's very difficult. And so they have to work much harder on it. So, but still, it's a wonderful thing. And thank you, Bhakti Greg. He's flattering me. Now he's making me think each week I have to come to this standard. All right? We will come to the standard. We will surpass the standard of this week, next week. We'll surpass your expectations. If you'd like to do the live course is just, it's just so wonderful to be in the association of devotees, and for a weekend doing this kind of work is fantastic. Or if you have the Shakti to organize such a thing in your community amongst non-devotees and rent a hall and get them to pay, or pay a little, or make donation, then we can do it with devotees and non-devotees. And you know what the wonderful thing about doing it with devotees and non-devotees is? That in this seminar, we partner up with another individual and we share a lot with that person. So when there are non-devotees mixed with devotees, the non-devotees get to hear the realizations of the devotees. And the realizations of the devotees are often quite deep. And it really, I've done this before, and I didn't realize it was going to happen, but I saw it happening. I could see the devotees were having this incredible effect on the non-devotees when the non-devotees would hear their realizations. Because devotees are, they're practicing Krishna consciousness in such a way that is quite unusual for the average non-devotee. So the, you know, the devotee's saying, I'm trying to be more humble, but I see my ego getting in the way, and I see how sometimes I'm not as self-disciplined with my mind as I should be, and I have negative thoughts, and I have bad thoughts about people. And, you know, the people are hearing this, and they're thinking, this is natural, everybody's like that. And they're looking at you, and they're saying, God, this person's finding one blemish on a white sheet, and they're feeling bad about it, oh my God. And then they start becoming purified by hearing about it. So if any of you are interested in arranging something with devotees and non-devotees together, that's very, very powerful, and a great way for people to meet devotees and befriend them in a neutral atmosphere that is not a program dedicated or they're coming to that's meant to preach to them or down to them on an absolute platform, but it's a discovery program where they'll discover issues about themselves and will relate it to Krishna consciousness. I want to have Shakti. Help me. Okay. I'll help you get Shakti. Write on a piece of paper, Madan Mohan, write on a piece of paper how to get Shakti. That's the question, how to get Shakti. And I want you to write down 20 ways you can get Shakti. 20 ways you think you can find some Shakti. And see what Krishna reveals as the super soul, how you can get that Shakti, what you can do. There are always possibilities that we haven't thought of. And this is one excellent way of coming up with the possibilities. So I'm sorry, there's a Hindu temple here. I bet people would come to hear you speak. There are many venues, yeah. If you can arrange it, talk to some people, the powers that be, and let's discuss it. And I'd love to go. This is very, very... I've done this seminar about 7 times. It's amazingly powerful. People get so much out of it, and it's such a nice way to give Krishna consciousness because they're getting it dealing with an issue that's personal. So it's not theoretical at all. Everything that they're learning is relating to dealing with the issue. It's a different way of teaching, and it's so powerful. So thank you. Yes, my email, mahat@aol.com. Yes. And we're going to put this class tonight on... what you may want to do, if you want to interest people in coming to the course, then let them hear one of these classes. If you thought this class was nice, if you thought this class was special, this will be forgiveness class number 8. We're going to put it on right after the show. Let them hear it. Give them a taste. It may inspire them to become interested. So, yeah, I like what I heard. This is very interesting. This is something I could use. So that's a positive way. Or you can direct them to the website. Or I believe you can download those. Can they download? Yeah, so you can download any of those. Feel free to share them. And then within a month or two, I'll have my own website up and I'll have all this information on there. And then if you go to my website, tstrain.com, if you go to newsletters, then you'll find an article that I wrote, a newsletter I wrote called Living a Life of Total Forgiveness. That's under newsletters, tstrain.com under newsletters. And as I mentioned, if you go to articles, you'll find the article entitled My Resentment. And you can direct people there, and then, or you can download it yourself, and you can have them read that, and that it can also enthuse them. Say, yeah, this is something I'd be interested in. So thank you very much. We will see you next week. We'll even have a better class next week. And I'm very happy you've all come. Tell your friends, spread the word, pass it around, listen to the other classes, and we'll see you again. Thank you. Hare Krishna.